Since 1886, the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, D.C. has been helping children in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Now they are visited by over 3,000 children every day. The club teaches character and leadership development and arts education. No child is turned away for being unable to pay the $25 fee, and the club needs your help to make this happen. Give a gift online at bgcgw.org. The life you lift up today will be the life that brings a better world tomorrow. This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
Newsmakers on the Dorabeck Insider.
Tom Trabucco, Director of External Affairs at the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board.
Somebody noticed a change in their account balance that didn't reflect contributions or earnings. So what we did is activated our core at the call centers to give them information for any of these folks to tell them of our plan to get this right. We'll notify all affected participants, offer to take the funds back, reverse the transaction, and make them whole.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Dorabeck Insider.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here to talk about estate planning, wills, trusts, and the like with Mark Levine, partner, Handler and Levine. Attorney par excellence, fellow seminar presenter, and going to teach us all about wills, trusts, estates, especially with the new monster change in the tax law. Finally, they got a direction, and you're going to guide us. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Everything's good. And Tammy Flanagan doesn't need an introduction, but we'll give her one anyway. Senior Benefit Director, NITP, weekly GovExec. Columnist. By the way, for those of you that don't subscribe, you should. It's free, and her articles are just clean, crisp. I've learned more about benefits in the 5 years you've been writing that than the 25 before that I tried to learn. So anyway, good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob. Thank you.
All righty. Mark, I got to ask my same silly, I won't say silly question, but it's a question that people ask me. What's an estate? How do you account for estate? Am I subject to estate tax? What is an estate?
So it's a good question. It's not a silly question. It's a good question, especially because we when we say estate, we could mean a lot of different things. And people mean different things all the time when they talk about their estate. And there's really two big pieces of what an estate is. And we're going to talk about, I think, more about one of them today than the other. The one we've talked about in the past is your probate estate. Going through probate, your stuff that's subject to going through a probate in court and how it goes from you to somebody else.
And what's a probate?
Probate is the state process of determining what you owned and who it goes to and making sure it's properly accounted for.
So in other words, when one passes, it wasn't good enough that they taxed us all our life. We are then taxed on our net assets, if you will, assets minus liabilities. And that's called, when we do the accounting, is that probate?
Nope, probate is the process, is the state process of determining what you own and who it goes to. The tax part of it is the estate tax, and the estate tax is essentially a tax on the transfer of assets from you to other people. So what you have isn't necessarily all that's included in your estate, because it also includes life insurance and other things that go from you to somebody else at the time of your death. And so figuring out what is your estate is sort of the first step in figuring out, hey, do I have to deal with these estate taxes? Are they going to affect me? Are they going to impact me? But it's important to understand it's not just what you can hold, what you can spend, what you can do something with. It's also what passes at your death to someone else.
Okay. And the listeners may be under the impression that, oh, estate is just for somebody very wealthy when you see some of these numbers. But that, correct me if I'm wrong, that's not necessarily true, because whereas the federal estate tax might be at a high threshold, the state estate tax may not be.
That's right. I mean, different states will have their own state estate tax. And that state estate tax goes anywhere from a low of about $340,000 limit in Ohio to a high of $3.5 million right now, I think, in North Carolina and Delaware.
Wow.
So you know, where we are locally, we have three different jurisdictions, Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. Virginia doesn't have an estate tax at all. So the only thing you're concerned about in Virginia is, what's my federal estate tax estate? What, do I qualify? What's going on with that?
Should we all move to Virginia?
That's an entirely different question. As I often
Tammy
say,
was smart. She already did.
We got plenty of room.
you don't want to let the tax tail wag the life dog. So moving to Virginia just to escape the estate tax, you might want to do a little more
we
research.
Got personal property taxes.
Exactly. There's a bigger picture in place. But Maryland and D.C. do have a separate state-level estate tax, and the exemption level in Maryland and D.C. is $1 million. What that means is if your total net estate for estate tax purposes is over $1 million, you're going to have to pay an estate tax in Maryland or D.C. if it's going to a non-U.S. citizen spouse.
So what would normally be in an estate? I'm sure our listeners are saying, well, yeah, my checking account, my savings account, potentially my retirement plan being an IRA or TSP, but are cars and stocks and uncle or aunt.
And I think a tie-on question to that I have is, what determines whether or not you have to go through probate? Is it if everything goes to your spouse, you know, when one spouse dies and the other one, is that an exemption? Or what if your estate's so small that you only have left a house worth $50,000? So is that going to put you into that same situation? So are there some guidelines there?
So, two very different questions. The probate question is really about how the assets are titled. Are they titled in your name? Are they titled in jointly with you and your spouse? Are they titled jointly with you and someone else? And do they have a beneficiary designation? So, for example, the house that you're talking about, if that's joint with rights of survivorship with your husband, then no. At your death, it goes right to him. It doesn't go through the probate process. If it's just in your name, or if it's what's called tenants in common, then it is going to go through the probate process to determine who's entitled to it, make sure all your debts are paid, and make sure it goes to that person. If it's life insurance, for example, and your spouse is listed as your beneficiary, it's going to go straight to your beneficiary. It's not going to go through probate.
What if you die in one state and then you have property in another state? Which law prevails?
So the law where where you live, where you're domiciled at the time of your death, is where your primary probate is going to be. Those assets that are physically located in another state may be probated in that state. So if you live in Virginia and own real estate in Maryland, your estate is in Virginia. Bank accounts, brokerage accounts, all the intangible stuff, that's all dealt with in Virginia. The real estate and actually the personal property that's physically located in that real estate that's located, what's called, has a situs in Maryland, that's going to go through a Maryland probate.
So and not be included in your Virginia estate.
It's not going to be included in your Virginia probate. That's
okay.
Correct. Yep.
Okay. That's good to know, because I think a lot of people have that question, because some of us think, well, we don't have that much, or mom doesn't have that much, you know, so is that going to get us out of the whole probate thing? But not necessarily.
No, probate, there
are. It's not based on the size of your estate.
There are different levels of probate. So there are small estates that if you have less than $30,000, for example, in Maryland in your estate, it's a small estate. It's a much simpler process. Mm-hmm. If it's $50,000 but going to a spouse, it goes through a small estate process. There's also some states like D.C. has unsupervised administration, which makes it easier. Maryland has something called modified administration, which makes it easier if everyone is a spouse and children and things like that. So where you live, probate is a very state-specific process. Where you live has a tremendous amount to do with what probate is going to mean to you. Virginia probate generally is harder and more technical and takes longer than D.C. probate if everything is set up correctly, for example.
Huh. Okay, this is, of course, very good information. It's about 10:15. It's Monday, January 10th, 2011. We are live, but probably just for another 40 minutes. So if somebody would like to call, please do. We're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. After about 10:58, don't call because we won't be here, but you can email us. We'll give you the email address later. Phone number is enough to absorb now after Mark and Tammy's discourse. Let's get back. So we talked about probate-ish stuff and you know what an estate is. Now let's do this tenants in common thing. How do I know if I'm a tenant in common?
You look at the title of the asset. It really comes down to, what does the deed say? What does the bank account say? what does the title to this asset say? So if the house you own with your sister and it says tenants in common, that means you own your half and she owns her half. If it says joint threats of survivorship, that means that at your death, she's going to get it regardless of what anything else says, regardless of what your will says, regardless of what your other intent is, the title's going to control. So that tenants in common is really personal to you, and it doesn't go anywhere automatically at your death.
So if you have it the first way where you own your half and she owns her half, then if you die, your half can be left to somebody else. It wouldn't necessarily go directly to her.
That's correct. And it would go through probate.
Oh, okay. That makes a big difference.
That's important because I think we, all three of us in the classes, somebody will come up and say, I want to add my friend, my child to on my house so that they won't have to pay probate taxes. But they have to be very careful, from what I'm hearing.
Well, for a number of reasons. I mean, we spent a lot of time in class talking about ownership and maintaining control over your asset. When you make someone a joint owner of a house, they're a joint owner of your house. And if you don't like what they're doing later, you can't make them give it back. Mm-hmm. So titling to assets, it's not just – there's no such thing as joint ownership for purposes of estate planning only. It's all or it's nothing. And so you really have to be very careful when you make these kinds of transfers. There's also gift tax consequences when you make transfers of real estate or joint accounts or assets to people as well.
And it's future ugly income tax. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you put somebody's name on an asset, whether it's a stock, whether it's a house, whether it's a whatever, you really give them your interest in it at the time that you change it from your name to theirs. So that's, let's say it's 50-50 tenants in common. And then they go to sell it after you die, don't they? Not only did you give them half the interest in the house, but you also gave them half the tax liability.
Well, the issue is basis, basically.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not so much with a joint asset, but if you give someone an asset, they take it at your basis. So if you bought the house for 50, you gave it to them when it was worth 300, and it was worth 400 when you died. At the time they go to sell that property, they've got to pay capital gains tax on $350,000.
Yeah.
If they inherit the property, they get what's called a step-up in basis. And so it's treated as though they bought the property at the date of death. So it's treated as though they bought it for $400,000, sold it for $400,000. They pay no estate tax, no capital gains tax at all. So when you make a gift of an asset during your life, it's really important to sit down with an accountant or an attorney and make sure it makes sense for you. It makes sense in lots of situations. We do it all the time, but it's something that if you do it wrong, you can't undo it, and it can have devastating results for capital gains purposes.
Yeah, and not that I practice what you do, I don't, but people, when they come in and talk, invariably will get into that discussion, and I go, when you give them this, you also give them that, that meaning the potential tax liability, and do you really want them? There's a time and place to do it. Now, in the perfect world, there is no perfect day because you don't know.
Right.
And you don't – sometimes people want to gift money up to the maximum. And I said, well, be careful now. The best time to give them money would be when you don't need it anymore. And they look over and say, when's that? And I go, oh, it'll be clear.
The decision to make lifetime gifts for a lot of people is a very, very hard decision because we like our stuff. And we want to be sure that's there for us to use if we want it. So making a decision to sort of let go of it, you have to be really sure. And there are a lot of people who I can tell them with absolute certainty as an estate tax matter, they should be making the maximum gifts they can make. That there's no question from an estate tax point of view they should be doing this. But that doesn't mean that it's something that they are really able to do emotionally. And it really has to be both. You have to be comfortable doing it as well as actually able to do it in terms of what your financial situation is.
Okay. We actually had an email that came in over the weekend knowing that you were coming. And I'll paraphrase the email. And it gets into a little bit what you were just saying. And the question is, I plan on leaving my assets to my nieces and nephews. Can I set up a will that gives the money if they accomplish certain goals or they don't get into trouble? I'm just paraphrasing. So I think the non-technical term for this is controlling from the grave. I don't know that the will can do that. And you're the maven
right
here. How could they do this without trying to do that through the will?
Well, basically, you can do it through the will, but what you do in the will is set up a trust. What he's talking about here is creating a trust to control the assets after his death. You can create a trust during your life, or you can create one that only comes into existence when you die. That's called a testamentary trust. So what he wants to do here is, in his will, create a testamentary trust that will hold the money after his death and will parse it out to his beneficiaries when they are doing the things that he wants them to do. And most of the things that he's talking about here in terms of education and working and things like that are things that you can control. You can say, I'll pay for education, you'll continue to get this as long as you have a job, etc. There are certain things that you can't control. There are certain things that are against public policy that you can't, you know, say if you don't do this or you do this, or if you belong to this religion or that religion, you'll get the money or not get the money. Those things are considered against public policy. But the things that he sort of talked about, working, graduating from college, are clearly things that you can say you get this money if – you do these things.
Mm-hmm. And my simple way of looking at things, there was a movie years ago, it was a Richard Pryor movie, so I'm dating myself, and it was called Brewster's Millions. And the uncle passed and was going to leave the money to this guy, Brewster, but only if he spent some awful, disgustingly amount of money on whatever they, and, but he had to spend it within a certain period of time.
Yeah,
and if
I remember
he did
that
it,
one.
Then he would get the rest. Then I understood.
We're just like someone who wants to leave the money to someone who's going to care for their pets.
Right, absolutely. I mean, there are pet trusts. Mm-hmm. There are trusts for minor children. There are trusts for adult children. You know, what we really stress when we're talking to clients is, what's the purpose here? What are we trying to do? And if it's somebody who could do damage to themselves with the money, you want to hold it in trust. If it's somebody who will waste it, will need it later because they are not able to take care of themselves, then you want to control what's happening.
That would be like a special needs trust if you have a handicapped child.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that, you know, what you have to decide is, people think it's easy. People will say, well, I want to give them all the money outright immediately, but I never want it to go to anyone that they're married to. Well, you can't have both. You can either have it be very simple and efficient, or you can control it, but you can't have it be both ways. And I think that's where a lot of people get tripped up, because you start talking to them about what kinds of controls you have to set up and what kind of entity now exists for the rest of this person's life, and that's where they often will back off and say, never mind.
Okay, could I go back to the estate part, but with a focus on what we're just talking about? So if we wanted to set up this trust, could we take a chunk of cash while we are living and set up the trust? Or if we had the option and say, well, I'm not so sure I want to do that, could I provide for a trust to be funded via my assets when I pass in my will? So my will would say, I want to set up the XYZ trust for the benefit of, as long as they graduate from school. Can it be done at either time?
Yeah, absolutely. There are different impacts. If you do it before you die, it's a gift. And so you may be using part of your lifetime exemption, or you may be using part of your annual exclusions to create this gift. There may be some impact on your estate tax later on down the line. Or you can do it as a testamentary trust, a trust that comes into existence when you die. So, for example, if my wife and I are both gone, we've created a trust for our minor children. We have three little girls. They seem great, but who knows, you know, all the twists and turns of their lives. So we have a trust for them that goes for a certain amount of their life, controlled by a trustee, my sister, who is going to use it for certain things that we've set out, and also has the flexibility to use it for other things.
Okay. Because the emailer and I have been emailing back and forth for at least a year now, I do know where the person lives, and it is California. I don't know if you're conversant with California gifts and stuff like that or not. It's an unfair question, but like if you were to ask me about California income taxes, yeah, they have one.
Yes. I don't know what the state gift tax rules are in California. I can tell you that the federal gift tax rules are going to cover everyone. And so that's certainly something that he's going to want to look at if he's making a lifetime gift.
He could elect to do it in the will.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then it just all is part of his estate anyways. And the taxes will probably be exactly the same in that situation as if he had left it to them outright in terms of the estate taxes.
Great. All right. Thanks.
Sure.
And Mark, is there a protocol? And probably not. I'm assuming not. But let's say you had a client that came to you that was an elderly widow, and she has four grown children. And one of her grown children passed away, but all the kids have spouses and grandchildren and so forth. So would you advise that widow then to change her will so that everything of that child that's deceased would go to the grandchildren, or would you just leave it to the other three adult children? You see it both ways?
You generally see it so that it's going to pass down to the deceased child's children. In other words, most
people... Not to the spouse.
Not to the spouse.
Not to the in-law.
There's always situations. I have clients who, you know, their son's been married for 40 years. They don't have any kids, but that, you know, his wife has been part of their family for 40 years. And they specifically said at his death, it goes to her because that's how they consider her after 40 years.
Right.
Most people want to say, no, it's not going to go to the spouse. It's going to go to the children. And so usually wills are set up so that it says to my son, if my son predeceases me, to his children equally.
Mm-hmm.
So his share, his 25% in that scenario would get split up between his five kids. They'd each get 5%, for example. So that's generally the case. Not always. Everybody's family is different. Mm-hmm. Everyone's situation is different. But the vast majority of time, it's going to stay in the bloodline. Yeah.
Right. That makes sense.
Okay. We're living in certain and uncertain times. What I mean by that is if somebody passed in 2010, the press enjoyed talking about the billionaires that did and there was no estate tax. Wasn't always so good, but nobody's going to play the violin for a billionaire. I wish I could say our audience was populated with billionaires, but I doubt it. So then Congress finally passed a law because it was to revert January 1st, 2011, to be an extremely low amount.
Right.
And they changed the law, and it's still pretty high. What's it now? If somebody passes, I know there's intricacies to this, and we'll get there. Just the threshold is pretty high for a single person versus a joint.
It's always based on a single person to start with. So it's a $5 million federal exemption. What that means is that if you're gross estate is $5 million or over, you have to file an estate tax return. If your net estate is $5 million or over, you have to pay a federal estate tax.
Okay, now net would be a gross estate is kind of like all my assets, ignoring what I might owe, mortgage on a house, personal loan, car loan, etc. So it's kind of plus minus equals $5 million. We're going to pay something. And for most of us, we're not going to pay anything.
Right.
The listening audience.
Correct.
Some of them.
Right. The goal, as I tell people, the goal is to have an estate tax issue.
Yes.
That's what you're shooting for. But
to even someone who has a smaller estate, there still has to be a final tax return, right, for that deceased person?
Well, for income taxes, yes. But for federal estate taxes, no. In other
Unless
words, if you've got a $1 million gross estate, you're not going to have to file a federal estate tax return at all, a Form 706 at all. That, however... You know, one of the intricacies that we've talked about and one of the things that people have heard is about portability, spousal portability, and that in theory, you know, a husband and wife now have together $10 million and they don't have to plan for it, et cetera. In order to use your spouse's unused exemption, you do have to file an estate tax return even if you didn't have to normally.
Hmm.
So again, one of the things that I think are going to trap people going forward with this is that they think they don't have to file anything, which was true previously, but now in order to take advantage of some of these new things that they've given us a chance to take advantage of, you do have to file the return in order to do that. And going back to 2010, if somebody died in 2010, it's a good idea, especially if their estate was over about $1.3 million or so, to go talk to an attorney or an accountant to find out, should we file a return even though we didn't have to under 2010 because of that step-up in basis issue we were talking about.
If they wanted to talk to you, how could they?
They could call me. Our phone number is 301-961-6464, and my extension is 3313. Email is Mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com. That's handlerlevine.com. And the website's www.handlerlevine.com. And my phone number again, 301-961-6464.
Okay. And if you use GoDaddy, don't email him.
Bob, I can't get Bob's emails right now.
This is odd. I mean, and finally I asked the computer person, I said, what did I do to Mark? And he goes, nothing. You got the wrong. Well, there's nothing wrong with GoDaddy.
That's right.
But because our computers don't talk to me, I either have to send it through Tammy or Nancy or fax it. And anyway. Tammy, your question about income taxes, again, I think a lot of people that are not aware of it feel that if the person dies, why would they possibly have to file income tax? Well, income tax is totally different than estate tax, and there still is a liability. Clearly, the individual is not going to be preparing it, but they've named somebody in their will to administer things upon their passing. What do they call those people? They got all kinds of names, don't they?
And they might be the personal representative or the executor or the administrator.
Okay, so if somebody is preparing their will or have prepared their will, that person should not just be a friend. It should fine if it's a friend, as long as they understand where to go to get professional help, because it's highly charged. And you bring up a good question. There is a tax return due. Now, who's going to do it? Well, the person in charge of the affairs is either going to do it or get somebody to do it.
I guess there could be two tax returns, because like with my mother-in-law who just recently passed away in January of 2011, she had a little bit of income, I guess, this year, mm-hmm. plus all of her income from last year that hasn't been filed yet. So is that possible that there has to be one for 2010 and then another one next year?
Without question. They may not have to file the 2011, but I find sometimes they just do it anyway, not to generate a fee, mm-hmm. but just to so IRS doesn't send a letter, where's the return?
Right.
And it's clear the person passed because there's a block on the return.
Because that wouldn't be indicated on the 2010 return because she didn't die in 2010.
It could be, but it doesn't have to be. Okay.
But there's probably or often is going to be a third tax return due because those assets of hers from January 2010 until you distribute them are also earning income.
Oh, yeah.
And so someone's always has to pay the income tax. Mm-hmm. It's always going to happen. If there's a tax due, someone's going to have to pay it. And so you may have not only her 2010 return or her 2009 return, her 2010 return, you're also going to have a fiduciary return for her estate or her trust from the time between when she passed away and the time when you distribute everything. So you may have a third.
Huh.
That's right. You may have a third income tax return as well.
Wow. Things you got to know.
Yeah. Now you know.
Who would know?
I think Bob made a really good point, which is whoever you appoint, a lot of people say to me, well, I should appoint you, right? The attorney, the mm-hmm. accountant. I said, what's really appropriate is for me to be the attorney for the estate or Bob to be the accountant for the estate, and that you have someone you trust with common sense, most important quality, common sense, who knows to hire an accountant and hire an attorney. It doesn't have to be Bob. It doesn't have to be me, even if I prepared it.
Mm-hmm.
But that they hire someone to do those things.
So it gets done right.
Professionally. That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Don't feel like I have to do it myself because he named me.
Because what are the consequences then that money that was distributed may have to come back and pay back taxes or back whatever is due?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the one way that a personal representative is going to get themselves in trouble is if they distribute money, find out the estate owes money, and then they can't get it back.
And then the person in trouble is that representative.
That's right.
Ooh.
And that's why people don't distribute money. When we represent personal representatives, we say to them, listen, you've got to make sure that you keep enough so that you can pay all the debts, the taxes, all the things that are due. Because I guarantee you, if you distribute it early, it's spent. It's gone. Mm-hmm. Assume that those beneficiaries are giving it back. They're not giving it back. And so you become responsible.
And that person should have somewhat of a strong backbone, because if they're dealing with relatives, relatives are fine. I love all my relatives. But I've seen where other people didn't have the same relationship with their relatives. And, well, you know, Aunt Nellie or Uncle Harry wanted me to have this widget. And they told me so. Well, it isn't in the will. It isn't anywhere else. And then you have to be the police person. That widget might be worth a lot more than the other widget. Mm-hmm. So they have to be
a touchy
tough,
job.
But not nasty. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very hard job. If you know, people all the time say, well, we all get along and everything will be fine. And
until the crisis hits.
And you know what? 90% of the time it is. But that 10% of the time takes up 90% of my time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 90% of what I end up, dealing with in terms of estates are the 10% of the time people aren't getting along. And that's inevitably when someone has done something that makes perfect sense.
It was intuitive.
Mm-hmm. But it was wrong. And you've got to back away now and try and figure out a way to help them fix it. And inevitably, they're the ones who didn't come in when someone died. Really important that anyone passes away, go talk to a lawyer. Buy an hour of an attorney's time. Find out what you need to do, because it may not be what you think you need to do.
And I think another thing to distinguish, which is something I have to admit I was ignorant about till not that long ago was the difference between an estate planning attorney and an elder law attorney.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people are confused about when do you use estate planning attorneys versus elder law, especially when you're dealing with elderly parents who may have just passed away.
Yeah. You know, for me, it's sort of a conceptual thing. It's very much elder law attorneys are very often helping you spend down, get rid of money, get
prior
it out
the
of
death.
The person's estate prior
mm-hmm.
to going into a nursing home,
right.
for example. Whereas what I'm trying to do is conserve assets. I'm trying to make sure that you have as much as possible when you pass away. So for some people, it's sort of a philosophical decision they have to make in their life or in their parents' life. You know, where are we?
Mm-hmm.
Are we heading down this road or are we heading down that road? And so very often an estate planning attorney is going to give you advice and work with you on something that is directly contrary to what the best elder law decision is and vice versa.
Right.
So you really have to know, where are we going with this? What's our ultimate goal here? And sometimes it's just a question of how much, you know, what are the assets? How are they structured? And is the person going to need that much service, that much care down the line that we need to start preparing for it?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way, while someone's alive, let's try to walk the chalk line between the two, the elder care concern or elder attorney concern, not saying it's the attorney, but the individual would go and say, how can I take this asset, move it over into this, let's call it a trust for the sake of simplicity, such that the person would still enjoy any benefits of the trust but wouldn't have any Medicaid issues should they arise? Is there such a beast?
Yeah, I'm not an elder law attorney. I will tell you that I would say that that's sort of the grail that people seek. That's what everyone wants. People come in and say, well, I want to set up a trust. I want to avoid probate. I want to avoid any possible creditors ever getting it. I want to avoid all estate taxes, but I want it to be completely revocable. I want to be in complete control of it, and I don't want anyone to ever be able to interfere with my use of the asset. Those are the sort of things that people want. And you generally can't have both. You know, very often you're deciding, do I want control or do I want efficiency?
Mm-hmm.
And very often the best we can do is figure out the most control with the most efficiency. But you're never going to get all the efficiency and all the control. And by control, I mean creditor protection or things like that in one place, because they're opposite from each other in some ways.
Okay. For those listening now, we're not preaching trying to do the government out of any taxes. Sometimes I get this in class. I said, no, I'm just trying to make people aware, because there are people that think like that and there are people that don't think right. But whatever it is, here's how it works.
There are rules. And our job is to help people figure out the rules. We try and make sure that you maximize what your rights are. And you have a right to protect X amount from estate taxes. How do we make sure that we don't accidentally not protect money? And that's one of the biggest things we do, is try and make sure that you use as much of your exemption as possible, trying to figure out, and very often you can't, who's going to pass away first. And how do we make sure that these things are used up rather than left on the table unused? And that's a lot of estate tax planning, certainly.
Okay, I was at something the other day, and I think it was actually an estate planner. Can't remember to what day it was or what, and the old adage, you have to plan to write the last check before you breathe your last breath, and the check bounces. I don't know that anybody can do that. But
not everybody wants to do that. Some people want to leave money behind.
That's right, and I looked, and I kind of said, well, you know, that's not a size that fits all feet.
It's not even practical, because unless you come with an expiration date, how could you possibly do that? You want to make sure that, yes, there are people who say, I want to leave the maximum amount I can. And there are other people who say, I just want to make sure that I never run out of money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the end of the day, the only way to make sure you never run out of money is to try and preserve as much as possible, to use what you need and keep the rest stored up. What that may impact, though, is how much you give away and what you do with things like that. How much advance planning to avoid tax versus how much advance planning to just make sure you have control over the assets.
I think that's one of the issues with the thrift savings plan money that people have when they retire, because they have a certain amount of money that has to last usually for the rest of their lives. And they're trying to figure out, how do I take it out so that I don't run out of money before I run out? And some people do want to leave that balance to their beneficiary or to their spouse or other heirs. So I think that's what makes it hard to manage a lump sum of money as opposed to getting a life annuity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's, again, for the financial planners out there, that's their burden, mm-hmm. is to sit down with these people and say, here's what you're going to need, and here's how we plan for you to live on this. And then it's, you know, my job to say, okay, assuming that you die next year or the year after, because generally I'm not planning that people are going to die at 89. I'm assuming when we're doing planning, what if something happens next year or in 5 years or in 7 years,
right,
what happens? So generally when I'm talking to people, there's a sizable amount still there. It's not used up. If you only came to me, you know, when it made sense from a life expectancy point of view, all my clients would be 82 because no one thinks they're going to die, you know, before they hit their 80s. They're all going to last into that. So we plan for what someone said once, the morbid improbabilities, all of the what if you die, what if she dies, what if you die early, what if you die together, et cetera, et cetera.
It sounds like our survivor benefit discussion we have.
Exactly.
Which the other thing I had in the line of federal benefits is I think there's some confusion about beneficiary designations, because federal employees have beneficiary designations that govern their retirement money. They have it for their thrift savings plans, saving retirement savings account. They have one for their government life insurance, and they even have one for if an employee dies in service, what happens to your last paycheck, your unused annual leave, so your unpaid compensation. So there's four different beneficiary forms. And I have some employees who say, well, you know, I went to my estate planning attorney, I filed a will, we're covered. I don't have to worry about those beneficiary forms anymore. Is that true?
No. I'd say one of the biggest flaws I see in well-done estate plans and wills that were done properly and trusts that are done properly is that the beneficiary designations haven't been dealt with. For most people, and certainly all federal government employees, beneficiary designations are as important as your will. They control usually as many assets, as much of your wealth as any other single thing you're going to deal with. And so making sure that those beneficiary designations are done so that they work with your estate. Mm-hmm. Because if your will says, give my TSP to my husband, but your TSP beneficiary form says, give it to my ex-husband, your ex-husband gets it.
That's right. That takes precedence.
It takes precedence. It takes precedence over the divorce decree, over the separation agreement, over him saying, I won't take it. None of that matters. He gets it. It's his, and he doesn't have to give it back. So it's really important that beneficiary designations are done as part of the estate plan. And so when we talk in classes, when we talk to our clients, beneficiary designations are just another estate planning document that we do along with a will or a trust, a power of attorney, a healthcare directive. They really need to be done at the time the estate plan is done, so that everything sort of pointed in the same direction.
Right.
And it's not just federal benefits. It's an IRA you may have or a CD you may own, anything that has a beneficiary designation.
And I think employees also need to remember to treat those like legal documents, which they are, because they can be challenged after the death. Like Aunt Sue says, well, my sister meant to leave that TSP to me. And so she may challenge the beneficiary that says it goes equally to all three sisters.
She can challenge it if it's the filed beneficiary designation.
If it was accepted.
If it was accepted, it's going to control. I mean, you could.
Which
you know,
is why the TSP and others are so careful about accepting them, because they know what's required to be legal.
It's also why the one that's binding is the one they received before your death. A deathbed change of beneficiary form generally isn't going to be effective. You really need to get them filed and in and in force before you die.
That's right.
So they're really important documents, and people definitely underestimate their impact.
Isn't that in one of Tammy's top 10 suggestions?
But that's the one place where I think Mark and I overlap just a little bit, because when I talk about survivor benefits, that always comes up, and I always make sure I mention it. And if he mentions it the next day, that's great, because now they've heard it twice. Because you can't hear that enough. I think employees don't realize the importance of maintaining those accurately.
I think they hear it from me more than they I usually say it several times over the course of the seminar, because it's really important, and it's a thing that's really missed a lot.
Now, that's another thing, too, when we were talking about probate before. If you have beneficiaries named specifically, then those things don't have to go into probate.
That's right.
You leave money to your whoever of your life insurance, your TSP. Those are things that go directly and can be paid out immediately.
That's right. The person themselves will apply for them, and they're the ones who will decide how it's used and what it's used for and when they go and get it, because it's really under their control.
And the person, the executor of the will, doesn't dole that out. That's done directly between you and the institution who has the money.
That's right. That's right. The executor needs to know what was in there, especially for estate tax purposes, because while it's not in your probate estate, it is completely taxable in your estate tax estate. So they need to get the information about it, but they don't have any control over it. The other thing I'll say is a lot of people say, well, I'm just going to go by what the order of precedence is. The order of precedence says it goes to my spouse, it goes to my child, it goes to my grandchild, it goes to my estate. And that's fine, except that if you've created a trust for a spouse or you've created a trust for a child or a grandchild, that trust doesn't matter. If your beneficiary designation, if my beneficiary designation said to my wife, but if my wife predeceases me to my kids get it when they turn 18, mm-hmm. even if I have a trust in my will that holds it to their 40. Wow. Huh. So the trust that you set up can't go and grab the asset and pull it back. You actually have to direct the asset into the trust, or the trust is just an empty bucket. There's nothing in it.
So you can make all four of those beneficiary designations payable to the trust of Mark Levine
rather than
just to my kids who are in the trust anyway.
Absolutely. And you have to, the trust is meaningless. And that's what I mean. The biggest flaws I see, they've created trusts, but they haven't funded them. Nothing's going to go in them. They're not going to control anything. It just doesn't matter. And so you have to make sure that those beneficiary designations direct the asset into the right place.
Would all four of those be made payable to a trust, even the life insurance? Because I've heard there's some sticky issues with the estate planning or estate tax issue that life insurance could get in the way of.
Well, there's two things. I mean, one, the TSP, you really want to make sure that a trust is the right place because mm-hmm. there's lots of income tax issues with your TSP. So generally, we're going to say no. The TSP should go to the spouse, and if the spouse predeceases, go directly to adult children. If they can handle the money, give it to them. Because mm-hmm. from an income tax point of view, it's much better for it to go directly than through a trust.
Oh.
Life insurance, generally speaking, will be used to fund trusts because mm-hmm. there's no income tax issues involved. It's a very easy way to fund a trust for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
The issue with life insurance sometimes is how it's owned. If it's owned a certain way, it's not in your estate. If it's owned another way, it is in your estate. I think what a lot of people think is because it's group insurance, because the government, perhaps they think, owns it rather than them, it's not includable in their estate, and it is. Your Fegley benefit is 100% includable in your estate for estate tax purposes.
Which for some states, like the low, like Maryland threshold, it could cause
an
issue.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If you look at $1 million and you have any kind of multiplier on your Fegley, so you have $500,000 or $600,000 of Fegley and you have $200,000 in your TSP and you've got a house that has $200,000 of equity, you're at $1 million.
Right.
It didn't take you very long. You didn't have to look at anything else and you're there.
And some of those numbers are low in the D.C. area.
They're absolutely low. So you really have to think about, certainly for the state estate tax exemptions, where you live, what those limits are. You also have to remember that as happy as we are that they did something about the estate tax, they kind of stuck us back in the same situation they stuck us back in 2001, which is to say we have an answer for 2011. We have an answer for 2012. 2013, the exemption goes from the $5 million that they set it at back down to $1 million.
Oh, so we have to deal with this again in 2 years.
We're going to have to deal with it again. The tax rate goes from 35% for the next 2 years to 45 to 60% after 2013.
Yeah.
All I wanted, as I would tell seminars all the time, at this point, I no longer care what they do. I just want certainty. I just want to know that this is the rule going forward. And what they did was they gave us a rule and they said, but we'll, check with us again in 2 years and we'll see what we're going to do. So we could end up in the same exact situation 2 years from now saying, well, here's how they just blew up the estate tax.
Can I ask you three summary questions? Because we have about 11 minutes and this could easily take 11 minutes. The first question, and let me throw out the three. When should I be concerned about coming to see a professional like yourself? One. Two. How often should I get my engine tuned up and my oil changed? And three, how do I properly prepare before I meet you so that I get the most out of you and the time? I mean, let's be real. I bill by the hour. You bill by the hour. Tammy kind of sort of bills by the hour. And, okay, so let's go to the first one. When should I, the light bulb go off and say, I should go see somebody about my estate? Is there too early? Certainly there's too late. But
right. Yesterday was a good time.
Okay.
Basically, I think when you get married, you want to start thinking about that and thinking about what are your responsibilities if you're gone. Certainly once you have children, when you have kids, just like having a car, you have to get car insurance. You have to do certain things. You have a kid, there are certain things that go along with that. And having an estate plan, knowing who's going to be in charge of the kid as the guardian, who's going to be in charge of their money, who's going to be in charge of you if you're not competent, who also is then going to be able to access your money for that child, things like that. So certainly as soon as you have a family, having an estate plan, having a will and a beneficiary designation set up correctly and a trust and things like that really is mandatory. That's part of the deal. You really have to do that. As your life changes.
But what if I don't have a kid and I never want to get married, but I have a lot of friends?
If you care where things are going to go, then you've got a plan for it. So, for example, I have a client who has no other relative. He's got a niece and a nephew, and he has 30 different friends that he wants to leave money to. And so we have a will that goes on for, 15 pages talking about 5,000, 10,000, 6,000. But he cares about that. That's what matters to him. And so if you care where it's going to go, you've got to do an estate plan. You've got to make sure it's going to go to the people that you want it to go to in a way that makes sense for them.
Okay. How often do I get a tune-up?
So we usually suggest to clients that they come in every 3 to 5 years. We send out a letter out to our clients every 3 years saying, hey, it's been a while since you've been in. Come in. Let's sort of have a checkup. See what's changed. See what's different. The vast majority of clients ignore that letter completely. And so we send another letter out another year later saying, come in and let's talk. And again, sometime in that 3 to 5 year period, people will come in.
It's kind of like the dentist, huh? But it's not as painful.
I was going to say, and also I think you're supposed to do that annually.
Every twice a year.
That's right. Exactly. So birth, death, inherit money, move. Mm-hmm. If you win the lottery, I don't have to be the first call, but I should be in the top 10 in terms of things. So any of those things that are really going to change, if the people that you want to be in charge are changing, the number of times people come in and say, who did we name as the guardian? We don't even talk to them anymore. They got a divorce 7 years ago. And so there's all sorts of things you want to look at and make sure that it still makes sense for you. And that, so that checkup really makes sense to do.
I find in the pre-retirement courses, a number of people will come up and they'll talk. Mark was in here and I was embarrassed to say, this is the old adage, the I love you will, many years ago, where, my spouse gets everything. My best friend gets everything. That's it. But things have changed. Net worth has changed. Friends have changed. Maybe spouses have changed. If they didn't read Tammy's top 10, they wouldn't know this. But how do you see a lot of that?
Sweetheart wills.
Yeah.
They're basically say everything to my wife, everything to my husband. If we're both gone, everything to our kids. And, if your kids are in their 30s and well-situated and all of those things, that might work out fine. But what we find is certainly when kids are younger, you're going to want to trust. You're going to want something. And then that's going to change. As I say to clients, when your kids are between sort of 20 and 30, you may change your will 2 or 3 times because those kids, who they are, how they can handle money is going to change dramatically during that period of time. And then from 30 to 50, you may not change it at all. So you really want to look at what's changing in your life on a regular basis. But yeah, there's a lot of sweetheart wills. There's a lot of people who sort of did a quick will when they got married before they had kids. The worst cases are where people get married, have one kid, leave it just to that child. They name them specifically or they put them specifically on the beneficiary designation so that the other kids don't share in what they get, which we've had happen. So you just want to make sure that you look at your life and say, not just, well, will it eventually go to them? But also, is that the best thing for them? We really worry about a child getting assets at 18 or 21. They can really hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. They can do things that are going to affect them for the rest of their lives. We want to give kids enough money to do something, but never enough to do nothing. We want them to have to get up and go to work and have a job and do all the things that we did to make the money in the first place.
Sometimes it's hard to get people, a couple, let's say. Everybody isn't a couple, but let's say that there is, to even dwell on it because they're talking about one's not going to be there anymore. And I personally, I know that by personal experience, my wife and I had a hard time with it. Every time we talked about it, I don't want to talk about this. But more importantly, before I come to see you, I'm sure you have some forms to fill out. But what should I be thinking about before I even come in? Assuming I don't know anything more than what I just heard on the show. I know there's an estate now, but do I prepare a list? Do I write down all my thoughts? What would be your guidance pre-counsel?
Sure. We do have a questionnaire, and one of the nice things about the questionnaire is in addition to giving you a place to list assets, it also has a number of questions. And while some people will actually sit there and answer the questions, which is great, for a lot of other people, it's just the process of sitting down with their significant other and saying, what do we want for this? What does this mean? Let's talk about this. And people come in undecided very often. People come in to talk about what does this job mean? And from that discussion, very often I can help them, because when I tell them what that person has to do, they very often say, well, this person would be terrible then. You're right. We're not going to use your brother. Your sister's the right person to use. And very often it's the argument over people that keep people from coming in at all. The fear of death keeps people from coming in, and disagreement over who's going to take care of the kids keeps people from coming in, because they don't want to have that discussion, because then you sort of have to talk honestly about your family and about the fact that while I really trust your sister with our kids, I don't trust your brother at all. And so those discussions are good discussions to start having, but just because you haven't decided doesn't mean you don't come in and talk to the attorney, because whether it's me or somebody else, we've got years and years and years of sitting with people like you talking about these very issues. And very often we can give guidance because we've sort of heard and figured out solutions to these things before.
I've heard that there is a stumbling point sometimes with one spouse, or maybe both, assuming there is a spouse, as to how much money is needed in life insurance to educate the children or take care of them. And the one spouse say, oh, $500,000 will do it. Now, depending on the age, it's not going to get near doing it. And that's a lot of money. I'm not poo-pooing it, but a lifetime of care, clothing, education, the $500,000 isn't going to do it. And then the one spouse doesn't want to pay the insurance premiums to fund it. How do you break that logjam?
Well, ultimately, if there isn't the cash flow to pay the insurance, there's not the cash flow to pay the insurance. What I strongly encourage clients to do, and I don't sell insurance. I don't know exactly how much insurance you need for life purposes. I can tell you for estate taxes and things like that. What I can often tell clients is, compared to other similarly situated people, you don't have enough. And so based on that, I think you need more. And what I always tell clients is, go out, talk to someone, talk to an agent, someone who can rep different insurance companies, not just someone who reps for one, and find out. Get, you know, find out what it's going to cost for $2 million, $1.5 million, $1,500,000, and know what the real costs are. And then you can decide from a cash flow point of view, what can we afford? How can we afford this much? Well, first of all, a lot of people don't even know what it's going to cost. Go out, find out what it's going to cost to make sure that you know, you've really thought it out, what your family can afford. The other thing I'll say is, especially where one spouse stays home part-time or stays home full-time, and they think, well, they don't need to be insured, because really they're thinking we're getting insurance to replace salary. You are, but you know, if that stay-home spouse is gone, you're going to work less. You're going to want or have to replace that person with someone you're going to pay, and you're going to want to be able to spend more time at home. So...
okay, good. And that gets into financial planning, too.
Absolutely.
So we'll have a financial planner on soon, and then we'll direct some questions to them. Okay, final comments, Tammy?
I would just say, if you are wanting to update your beneficiary forms, go to opm.gov/forms, and you'll find all of your forms there, or tsp.gov.
Okay, Mark, quickly, how do we get in touch with you again?
The phone number is 301-961-6464, and the email is mark@handlerlevine.com.
Okay, great having you, Mark. Tammy, always good to see you, and we'll be on next week to talk about income taxes. I messed this up, but Ed Zirndorf and I are going to talk about the exciting changes in the tax law.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight for January is the museum's education program. School is back in session, and so is the museum's free admission program for local schools. Public and private school students, grades 1 through 12, in the Washington, D.C. area, will receive free admission to the museum when they visit as a school group. For details, including